All right, awesome. Okay, so I'm going to get started. And this talk is about using GIMP and Inkscape. But there's going to be a little bit of a decision point here, because I, unfortunately, so I abstained from playing Final Fantasy XIII for the past 3 days to come up with this presentation. And because I hadn't played the game in a while, I just wasn't thinking very straight. So I made the presentation a bit too long. So it's kind of, raise your hand if you're interested in the GIMP more than Inkscape. Okay, raise your hand if you're more interested in Inkscape. All right, cool. So probably what I'll do then is I'll kind of race through the GIMP stuff and spend a lot more time on the Inkscape stuff. All right, so that being said, who am I? I'm an interaction designer with Red Hat. I use Inkscape and GIMP pretty much every day on the job professionally, and I have been for like 5 years now. Like I mentioned here, my primary operating system is Fedora 12. I haven't used OS X, Windows, or anything Adobe since early 2006. And I just wanted to point out that you really can pump out professional-looking graphics without touching proprietary software. So that's where I'm coming from. So here's sort of just a rough outline of what I'm going to talk about. So the first question is, which program do I use? You may know that Inkscape and GIMP exist. You might not know exactly why would I use GIMP versus Inkscape and which is better and blah, 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 blah. So we'll kind of dive a little bit into the specifics of that so you can make an informed decision on which program to use for what. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about how you get source materials, because when you're doing anything creative, you really need to think about licensing. And I have some pretty good reasons why you should. So I will go through that pretty quickly, because that's sort of like, yeah, that's kind of a bummer kind of stuff, so I won't spend too much time on it. And then we'll do the GIMP. I'll kind of race through it so you guys can get to the Inkscape stuff. And then we'll talk about Inkscape a bit. And then I'll finish up with just a little bit of information about how you can learn more. So, which program do you use? All right, so here's the battle. Okay, so how many people here have already used Inkscape before? Raise your hand. Okay, cool. How many people already used GIMP before? Raise your hand. Okay, sweet. So we have a lot more GIMP users. So it really isn't a question of Inkscape versus GIMP. It's really more a question of vector versus bitmap. So bitmap kind of necessarily is photos are always bitmap. And a bitmap is literally just a map of bits. So you have a grid, and each individual grid is filled in with a pixel of some particular color. If you zoom in, you know, like those FBI crime shows where they take a satellite photo and they zoom in and they read the license plate number, like bitmap graphics really don't work like that, even though it'd be nice if they did. So when you're working in bitmap for more, you know, you're drawing a picture or something, you have to understand that you have to do it at the highest resolution you want, because you can't go back later and zoom in and make it bigger. So that's kind of, bitmap's not really great for illustration because of that fact, because when you zoom in, it'll look like in this flower. But, you know, it's what photography is used for, and the GIMP is really good for doing bitmap. So then we have vector. Now, vector is a really great way to design artwork, because, like I mentioned, if you do an illustration in vector, you can zoom in and zoom in and zoom in, and it's completely lossless, because rather than sort of maintaining a grid of pixels and information about each individual pixel and what color goes here and there, vectors are really more based on math. So it's sort of, we have point A at this XY coordinate and point B at this XY coordinate, and then they relate to each other in these ways. So not only is it lossless because it works based on math rather than a pixel map, but it also is a smaller file size too, which is kind of nice. And vector artwork is normally used, you know, for cartoons. It's used, sometimes people do photorealistic stuff like in this example. And it's also used for icons a lot. So a lot of the popular icon themes today, like Tango and the GNOME icon theme, those are actually done up in vectors. So is everybody really kind of comfortable now on the difference between bitmap and vector and the difference between Inkscape and GIMP? OK, cool. So now I want to talk a little bit about, well, OK, you want to create a poster or something, but you're not a painter, you're not a photographer. How do you get sort of source materials to work with to create your piece of art? So let's say you want a pony. You're going to do some kind of design with a pony in it for some reason. So I think a lot of people today would just go to Google Images and type ponies and just grab the pony that they liked. The problem is you really can't do that. You have to pay attention to the license of that pony. You can't just grab random images off of Google Images. You know, if something doesn't say it's Creative Commons licensed, if it doesn't say it's public domain, if it doesn't have any statement at all about the permissions for the photo, you really have to assume, well, it's copyright the author and you don't have permission to use it.
But in fair use, isn't there like a principle of substantive alteration? Like if you're just using it as like reference of a figure, but you...
Yeah, see...
There
really, it is a gray area. It's not a black and white. I know Shepard Fairey right now is kind of having some issues contesting that as well, and he's definitely pushing the lines. So I'm kind of just focusing on the safe area. If you definitely want to push the boundaries, you know, more power to you, but I try to play it safe. Sure.
I will say two things to that. One, we ask people to respect the licenses that we choose for our software. We should do the same for other people's choice or non-choice for art. The other thing is, so as to not bog down in licensing discussions, I am a lawyer. Come talk to me afterwards, and let her focus on what she's awesome at.
Although I would like to point out too that one of the reasons that I tend to play it safe maybe a lot more than other people is because when I do design work, I'm doing it for free and open source software, and I don't want free software to have any kind of legal issues. You know, so I kind of want to play it as safe as possible just because I don't want to, you know, affect other people. So anyway, that being said, here is a good reason why you shouldn't just grab random images off of Google Images. This poor fellow who is I think he's some kind of politician in Spain, will probably forever have trouble getting through airports because some FBI artist decided to take his photo off Google Images, superimpose Osama bin Laden's face on top of it, and say that is an aged version of Osama bin Laden. So, yes, please think of Gasper when you use Google Images. Okay, so, and this is also, I do this format in my slides, like it's a public service message, right? So, my second public service message here is, of course, give credit where it's due. Just because it says Creative Commons doesn't mean you can just use it and not mention the author or give them credit. I believe in Creative Commons. The author kind of stipulates how they want to, and maybe Chris, you could even give us a bit more detail about that if needed. Oh, go ahead, go for it.
There's different licenses, all of which have different restrictions, such as, and I'm not speaking for Creative Commons, but
okay. Exactly, because the different licenses, they don't always mix. Just because it says Creative Commons doesn't mean, you know, you can't take something that's Creative Commons non-commercial and then relicense it Creative Commons attribution, because then you're sort of violating the license. But even I try to play it safe, and I'll go with Creative Commons attribution license works, and I'll go with Creative Commons attribution share alike license works. And whenever I use these, I always make sure that I at least, you know, like here I have a slide presentation. So you'll see along the bottom here, really wasn't so hard. I just gave a little quick credit. You know, here's the author, here's the name of the work, here's the license. So then, you know, if you guys go back from this conference or whatever and you want to share information that you learned here with other people, you can share this photo and you understand exactly how you can in the terms of that. So just make sure that you give attribution where it's due. I know that when you're using artworks in software, sometimes it's a little weird. Like, I can't put a little clause underneath an icon, like that'd be a little weird. So if you just talk to the person who designed the artwork, they'll usually let you know how they'd like to be attributed, and if you explain the constraints that you have, then they're usually very willing to work something out with you. So that being said, these are just some examples of places that I use pretty much on a regular basis to get openly licensed materials that I can use. Open Clip Art is a great resource. It has all SVG artwork. It's all in the public domain, so you don't even have to attribute the artist, although it's great if you do. And these are great if you're trying to learn Inkscape. You know, maybe grab some kind of work that you like from Open Clip Art, open it up, and kind of poke around and see how they made it. You can learn a lot just by playing around with other people's artwork. Wikimedia Commons is also a great site. They have photos and artwork and illustrations that are Creative Commons, GNU documentation license, and public domain. So just be sure that you pay attention to the license again. CC Search is a nice one. It uses Google Images, it uses Yahoo Images and Flickr, but it filters them so they only show Creative Commons licensed content. CompFight is a site that I actually recently started using, and it filters Flickr for its Creative Commons attribution specific. You can also say non-commercial if you want, but I turn that off. DeviantArt is not an open source application, neither is Flickr or some of these other search engines. But that being said, DeviantArt has a built-in licensing system that lets you Creative Commons license work. So there are a lot of artists on Flickr or on DeviantArt who create works that are Creative Commons licensed. A lot of times too, if you see some work that you want to use and it's not licensed, if you talk to them, especially on DeviantArt, and say, hey, I want to use this for my piece of software or something, won't you license it Creative Commons? I've found that maybe 9 times out of 10, they're actually very willing to listen to you and relicense their work, so something to consider. And DeviantArt also is a good source for GIMP brushes. Color Lovers has GIMP palette files. It's not an open source site, again, unfortunately, but you can build color palettes and then export them as GIMP palette files, which you can use in GIMP and you can also use in Inkscape. So that's a good site to know too. And I'm going to post these slides on the wiki, by the way, so don't feel like you have to frantically copy them down, just so you know. I will post them immediately after this. And the final thing is just yourself, right? You are a great source of openly licensed materials. When you create works, I hope that you consider licensing them openly so that other people can build upon what you've created. Okay, and this is an example of CompFight, which is one of those Flickr search engines that I told you about. And this one, you can see up in the top bar where I put commercial, so that's basically attribution license and attribution share alike. So it's not showing me Creative Commons non-commercial. And then this is actually Open Clip Art recently debuted a new version for their UI, and it's quite nice. So this is sort of an example of the kinds of things you could find on Open Clip Art. Okay, all right. So let's start with our GIMP stuff, and we might move through it a little quickly. So I'm gonna kind of cover 3 main points in GIMP. And these are techniques that you can really use for any project. So I picked sort of a stupid pony project. But that being said, I think it's going to be really clear to you how you can apply these in other ways. The first technique I'm going to show you is mass. The second one is layer blending modes. And then the third is going to actually be a combination of both mass and layer blending modes. You can do a lot of really cool photographic effects with these. So we have our little pony, and he's in a cage, and we want to free him. This is a very common use case. When I teach classes, I teach classes to school kids a lot. Like, I just finished a class with middle school kids teaching them Inkscape. And this is one of the main things they want to do. They want to cut objects out of photos. So we'll talk a little bit about how to free the pony. So the first thing is, don't use the erase tool. I know that is probably going to be your first instinct, is to grab the erase tool and start erasing the photo around the pony. Don't do it. We're going to use a mask to do that. And the thing about the mask is that it's basically I'll show it here. It's basically a black and white, well, it's grayscale image, and it shows, okay, you're placing it on top of the photo, and it's telling you where it's white, show that part of the photo, and where it's black, just don't show that part at all. And the cool thing about this, as compared to the eraser, if you make a mistake, you know, a stray mark, maybe you cut off the pony's head by accident, if you want to add the pony's head back, you just paint in white to make it. So it's a really cool thing, and it almost looks like you're painting with the pony. It's really neat. So let's give that a try right now. Okay. And I apologize, the resolution on this projector is not the best, so things are going to be a little cramped. But basically what you do, so I have my photo, I'm going to right-click it in the layers area right over here, and I'm going to do add layer mask. And it's going to ask you a bunch of questions. Really, it doesn't matter. I'm going to pick white. So white means full opacity. So like in the presentation, how I was showing you, you have the white and black. So basically, that just says, if it's painted white, you can see through the mask. If it's painted black, you can't. So I'm going to take, this laptop is actually a tablet, so I'm going to cheat. But you could do this at home with a mouse, too. But actually, if you right-click this, too, you can see show layer mask. So see that? It's just white. So I'm going to hide it, though. And then I'm going to take black and white, and I'm going to start painting in black around the pony. And I'm actually using a really bad brush, too, so let me try to fix that. Okay, I can't see my brushes because the UI is tiny. So I use this. The GIMP UI does not work well at 800, but unfortunately. So anyway, you know, you see here, I'm just painting, la la la, and I'm just, you can see how I'm just erasing pony like crazy. And you know, again, like I mentioned before, I accidentally, whoops, there goes the pony's head. So, check out the masks. That's literally what the mask looks like, right? And what I can do, if I fill in black now around where I drew, when I go back to the picture, you're going to see, hey, it's not there. But yeah, the pony's head is missing, and that's actually kind of creepy. So I'm going to add it back by simply painting white. And you can see how, look, I'm painting with the pony. It's kind of neat. So one thing that actually is kind of a cool thing, too, is I'm going to show layer mask again. And I do that by right-clicking. I'm going to, I'm doing select all and then control X to kill it. So now it's all black. And then I'm turning off show layer mask so I can see the artwork again. And you see how there's nothing. So here, I can write, hi, mom, in pony. So see, masks are awesome. And here, I hope you cannot understand now why masks are way superior to using the erase tool, why you should just totally give up on the erase tool. Because you can totally just, you know, you make a mistake, it's not a big deal. You just flip between black and white. And you can also even do gray with a mask. So see here, it kind of makes it so it's a ghost pony. So, make sense? Cool. All right, so then we'll move on a little bit. Oh, and well, I guess another thing to know about masks is that sometimes you might get in a situation, and this is one of the things that I think trips people up about the GIMP in particular, using masks, is you see there's this checkbox, edit layer mask. So like you might be in this situation, okay, I love this crazy, weird pony drawing. And now I want to start working with the drawing itself, but wait a minute, I'm only manipulating the mask. So the way you fix that is there's this edit layer mask checkbox. Turn that off. When you turn that off, then it'll let you draw as if this was a normal drawing again. So see, now I'm drawing in black on top of the image. So that's just one point to remember. Okay. All right, so then, and this is one tool I actually used pretty briefly. I went through it kind of quickly, but the tool options palette in the GIMP is your friend. Whenever you have a tool selected in GIMP, whether it's a brush or if it's the eraser or if it's the selector, tool options basically morphs to present you options related to that tool. It also, if something in the GIMP is sort of acting weird and you're not really sure why it's doing that, tool options usually has the answer. So for example, when I was doing the brush, and I was like, wait a minute, this brush isn't big enough or whatever. This is right here, is the tool options palette. So you can see how it's all information related to the brush, and I can change different aspects about it. If I went to the pencil, you see it switches to be pencil specific. For the fill tool, this is one thing that trips people up a lot. If I have pattern fill turned on, you know, actually that's not gonna work because of this artwork, but if I have pattern fill turned on, it doesn't show in that lower left corner of the toolbar. So then you start wanting to fill in black, and you're like, why is it filling in wood? So check the tool options box, and that'll kind of show you what's going on. So, all right. All right, so now we're going to talk a little bit about layer blending modes. Layer blending modes, like I know a lot of you guys before this talk were saying, well, I'm not an artist and you're going to teach me the tools, but I don't have an artistic sense. But the thing is that, you know, you can take works that other people have done that are appropriately licensed, and you can just apply different filters and things in GIMP and kind of come up with cool derivatives of that artwork without even being able to, like, draw a tree or whatever. So these are some examples of different layer blending modes where I'm taking the photo of the pony and I'm putting it on top of itself and blending it in different ways. So in the upper left here, and I don't know if you can see my arrow, you got the pony, and then there's the pony on top of the pony. It's blurred, and I set it to overlay. And that kind of gives it sort of a hazy, glamour shots, sort of weird, romantic kind of look. Then I have the pony on top of itself, and it's using the burn filter, so it makes things kind of really dark and really high contrast, and almost kind of feel how it's burnt. Then there's the dodge one, and that makes things really bright. It's almost the opposite of burn. And then this one, I just sort of, this one in the lower right, kind of looks like the pony, whoa, kind of looks like the pony had some sort of nuclear accident or something. But that's a combination of, I have three layers of pony, and they're each set to a different blending mode. So you can see that you can stack the blending modes in different orders. And if you take the same blending modes and switch the orders, you can actually get different effects. Here we're going to show you can take the pony and something else on top of it and blend it in different ways. So here you can see I have a pink pony. And the pink pony is pink because I have the pony and then a solid pink fill. And the solid pink fill is blending to that pony using the color blend method. There's a wooden pony here too, and I just basically took the GIMP's wood pattern, filled it on a layer, then blended it on top of the pony. I have a rock pony, same deal, it's just a rock texture. And then I have a bubble pony, same deal, it's a bubble texture. You can also blend different photos, and you can kind of come up with really cool things blending two different photos. This is really not a great example, unfortunately, but you can just see how the two different ponies are sort of interacting in different ways depending on the blend. So this is sort of just a rundown of the basics. You can blend it against itself, you can blend it against a texture or fill, or you can blend it against another photo. So let's give it a shot. Let me clean this up. So when I'm bringing one photo into a photo that's already opened, what I do is when I go to the file menu, I do open as layers. Then it opens it in the same file. Then I don't have to copy paste. It's just a quick shortcut. How do you enable it? It's in Windows, Dockable Dialogues, Tool Options. It's always on the top. Okay, so here, I'm going to start with just the pony. And I'm going to, this right here is really cool. If you're using layer blending effects and you're blending the same layer, you hit this one, it just makes a copy in place of that layer. So you don't have to copy paste again. You just hit it and it duplicates it. So this right here, there's 21 flavors of layer blending modes for you to play with. So here, like, I'll start, here's the burn effect on the pony, and you can control how strong it is. This basically is controlling the transparency of the burnt layer. You can do this a bunch of times, and you can see as I add more and more, it gets more and more burnt. Poor pony. And you can try different ones, and then sort of if you want to see how they look in different orders, you can just hit the eye icon to kind of turn different ones on or off. So that's one way to do it. Here, now if I want to blend the two ponies together, I can use overlay, and I can start. Oh, wrong one. So this, okay, I actually ran into an issue that I think you might run into when you start doing this on your own. I started changing the layer blending mode and the transparency, but I had the wrong layer selected. So I was doing it and nothing was happening. I'm like, what's going on? It's because I had the wrong layer selected and that layer was also hidden. So make sure you have the right layer selected. So here's the, you can see just kind of going through these, you might get some ideas for the kind of look you're going for. And different ones typically do different things. When I'm trying to do sort of a nice effect on a photo, what I'll typically do is I'll take the photo and I'll duplicate it, And I showed this in the examples. I'll add a bit of a blur to it, you know, very slight blur, like I'll do 10. And then I overlay it. And it gives it kind of a softer feel. It's like if you go to a professional photo studio and they sort of glam you up, that's probably what they're doing to make it look like that. So that's this in there. So I think, yes. So the next part of the slides show you can combine both techniques. So you can do the mask, and then you can also do the layer blending to do different things. A popular thing that people do using this technique is to change the color of their hair. So basically, we took the picture of the pony, and then there's a pink fill, and then the pink fill only applies to the pony where you draw with the mask. So that's maybe we'll do that as an example. Another one here is you have the pony, and you painted with the pony with a painterly mask, so it looks like the pony is made of chalk or something. Here in the upper right, I used the pony as the mask itself. So the pony is the mask masking a wood pattern, and it's turned on to burn. So it almost looks like the pony is burnt into wood. And then I have, of course, the pony with the pink hair and his friend, which is kind of obligatory when you're dealing with ponies to have ponies with friends. Is all this, you guys are, I'm hoping I'm not losing you. Am I doing all right? Okay, cool, all right. So, which type of pony would you like to learn to do? Any preferences?
Pink hair.
All right, we'll do pink hair. Okay. And I'll do it with like that soft romantic one that I already did because I kind of like that. So, all right. So, what I'm going to do first is I'm going to merge this layer down so I have one soft romantic pony. And I'm going to delete these other guys. All right. So then I'm going to add a layer. And we'll pick a shade of pink. Do we want like Barbie pink or Hello Kitty pink or any preferences? Okay, I like Hello Kitty too. It's kind of pink. All right, so all I'm doing is I made a new layer here, and it started out transparent. I could also do foreground, but I tend to like transparent. And then I'm just using the tool bucket, the toolbar's bucket fill, and I'm clicking on it. And see? Oh, it filled in the wood. Like I said, that would be confusing. So I'm going to look at the tool options dialog here. And I'm doing foreground fill. There we go. That fixed it. So that happens to you. It happens to me all the time. You just turn it back on to foreground fill. Okay. So now I have a pink layer on top of the pony. And I am going to do the color method. So now that's a very nice pink, actually. Then I'm going to add a mask to the pink. So it only applies to the pony's hair. So I'm going to do add layer mask, and this time I'm going to make it black so it's full transparency so you can't see the pink at all. And I'm going to use white to paint on top of the hair so that the hair shows through. So I'm going to take white, and then as I paint, you can see there's that pink. I'm going to pick a better brush and kind of try to adjust it. But, you know, we could even do something, we could kind of give it pink stripes. It might be kind of a nice effect. But you see, here, you know, this is very different than, you know, say if I just took the pink from the palette here and I took a flat brush, you know, when I started painting, you know, it's very different. It looks more realistic because you're actually painting with the photo itself. You're not just painting with a flat fill. So it kind of gives it that nice kind of look. So there we have the pink pony. And you know, you can really experiment with this method. You can take the pink pony and you can do weird things to it, like, you know, you could use some filter, like, you know, I already used blur. Let's do, clothify. All right, so we're going to clothify the pony. I don't actually know what this filter does. Okay, that didn't really do much of anything, actually. Try again. Okay, and then what you can do is when you apply these filters to the image, then you can use layer blending modes to apply them to the image in different ways. So you can see here, it kind of makes the pony look a little cracked or something. But this way you can sort of, you can use filters, but it doesn't look like an obvious filter usage. You're kind of applying it and sort of judiciously measuring how much it affects the pony. So anyway, that was that. Does anybody have any questions about any of this? Either the mass or the layer blending modes or?
How did you get there, you know, when you showed two different ways to paint the paint on?
Uh-huh.
This one looked realistic. What was that?
The more realistic way?
Yeah.
Oh, I was just painting the mask. So see here? And actually, let me turn this off because it's. Oh. This is what I was painting. That's the mask. And if you kind of envision those white marks being a hole, and then the black part being sort of a block. So if I disable the mask and I don't show it, this is just a flat pink fill. And then that flat pink fill is being blended with the layer below so that it only applies to the color ranges of the photo underneath. Then what I'm doing is this mask here, I painted with white, and it's just flat white paint, but that's controlling how much of that pink layer, that flat pink color, is applying to the photo. So it's sort of, it's a combo of the two techniques. Does that make more sense?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. See, now I just applied it again. So disable layer mask, that's how you can see how it would look if you didn't mask it. And then that's what it looks like with the mask applied. So it's a really neat technique, and you can really expand how you use it a lot. And this is, you know, I've just done like a really basic example here. Like I was saying, you can mix things up. You can take photos of different objects and blend them in different ways and then mask them in different ways. So it's really good. And again, this kind of shows you, like, don't use the eraser. Use the mask. Because you can do these kinds of things and not have to worry about how clean you cut the line and all that kind of stuff. Oh, really? Oh, why didn't you say anything?
I can tell that the Firefox logo is gray.
Okay. All right. No. All right. Well, it's a blue-haired pony. All right. Let me know if anything looks weird, too, if it seems like I'm crazy or something, because that doesn't make sense, okay? Okay. So now we're going to do Inkscape, and that only took half an hour, so we have an hour left, although I want to leave room at the end for questions. So we have plenty of time for Inkscape. So first, we're going to do a simple lolcat, okay? How many people in here have already done a lolcat before? What? What's going on? Okay. Okay, all right. What software did you use for your lolcat? Did you use Inkscape or GIMP?
No, I think I actually just used Avery.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Why don't you ask who knows what a lolcat is, so I can...
Okay. All right.
I don't know what it is.
I will show you what a lolcat is. I will indoctrinate you into that part of society. Firefox, come on. Oh. You know what? I don't think my internet connection works. All right, if you have a laptop open, go to iKenHasCheeseburger.com.
Just Google for lolcats.
Yeah, Google for lolcats. Basically, oh, hey, that worked. Okay, maybe I can go. Hold on.
Oh, wow.
Stop. It's the delicious toolbar. If there's something going on the internet, it usually does that. Come on. Okay, you know what? I give up on that. It's basically you take pictures of cute cats, and then you come up with like little dialogues that the cats are saying. Like, I don't know, like you see one with like a cat, and it's on the toilet, and it's like, I can pee, I is cute cat, or something. I don't know. It's just like this cute thing that people do with cats, right?
Oh, lots of laughs. More cat.
It's more like just funny and cute. Even. The cats
yeah. Well, I'll show you guys an example, because we'll be making one. So when you're using Inkscape, this is one thing that, these are sort of just the basics that I tell people when I'm introducing them to Inkscape. Don't forget using the lock tool. And I'll show you where it is in the UI. It's basically along the toolbar on the top. But for some reason, it's turned off by default. So when you start drawing objects on the canvas and resizing them and moving them and stuff, the aspect ratio will get screwed up if this isn't checked off. So your thing when you're scaling it will get really skinny or really fat or whatever, and it'll look really weird and stretched. So always make sure that you have the lock turned on. It's just a little tip I like giving people. The other thing about Inkscape is use Control and Shift. They do interesting, magical things. They're different interesting and magical things depending on the tool that you're using. For example, if you're rotating an object and you hold down Control, it'll rotate at nice intervals that are even, so it's kind of a nice thing. For example, with Shift, if you have something on the canvas and you're moving it with the arrow keys and you hold down Shift, it'll move faster. So it's kind of a handy thing to do. So, oh, and I wrote down along the bottom, rotation, moving, undo, stroke, and fill. If you apply Shift and Control, they kind of do interesting, helpful things. So it's just something to think about when you're using Inkscape. Another thing in Inkscape that I tend to see beginner users running up into is you kind of get lost out in the ether of the canvas. You know, maybe a stray mouse click and suddenly you've scrolled all the way over here and your drawing is over there, but you can't find it. Hit 5. And it will center you on the center of the document, and you won't be lost anymore. So it's just one of those things to think about. I think this is my final Inkscape public service message, but use Control-D. Control-D, I don't think is something that a lot of art programs use. I don't know the proprietary tools that well, actually, so I couldn't tell you if they do. GIMP doesn't. But basically, if you select something in Inkscape and you hit Control-D, it makes a copy of it, it pastes it, and it positions it exactly over the thing that you just copied, which is extremely handy. So like if you wanted to make a grid of items, you can see here I took one item, I hit Control D, and then I arrowed it down. You know, I usually like count 1, 2, 3, 4, so I know it's exactly 4. And see here I have a field of 16 of them. And I did that by using Control D 1 time, 2 times, 3 times, 4 times. It was really easy, and I have 16 objects now, and they're all perfectly aligned because I use the arrow keys to align them. So just when you're creating things on the canvas, try Control D. It really is a nice shortcut.
Are these copies or clones?
It doesn't clone. If you want to clone, you can do Alt D. So cloning is sort of an advanced topic that I didn't intend to cover, but I can if we get through everything, if you have interest. Cloning is where you have one object, and say this object is like a, well, I guess a good example is text. So say this example is text, and it says hello. And that text is in a font that is, that's probably a bad example, actually. All right, you have a circle. You have a circle. And that circle is pink. So then you clone that circle. You make one here, you make one here, you make one here, we'll make one here. You take the original circle and you paint it green. Automatically, all these other circles also turn green. So it's sort of like the different, it links different properties. Where I was going with the text example, which is actually kind of an advanced example, is if you have a logo and you design the logo and it has some font and it has some bling on it or whatever, and say the logo is for lolcats, then you want to translate the logo so it says lolcats in Japanese. You could actually clone the logo that says lolcats, clone it here, and then change the text out from underneath it in the SVG. And it'll have the same styling and everything. You don't have to redo the logo, but it'll say it in Japanese. So that's one cool thing you can do with clones, too. I don't actually tend to use them that much, but they are handy when you need them. Okay. So this is sort of an example of a lolcat. We have a cat who is attacking Tux, and then he's saying, ooh, I'm an out-of-memory killer. So this is sort of an example of, you know, so you can kind of see what we're doing. And you know, again, this is a lolcat. It's kind of stupid. But it's a really common use case where you got a photo or you got some graphic and you just want to add text on top of it, and that's all you want to do. So there's a few techniques. I'll show you what I use most often, even though I think it's probably going to take a little bit. So what I do is I want to work with a bitmap in Inkscape, because again, it's a vector program. It's not a bitmap program, but you can still use bitmaps in it. I right-click the bitmap and I do open with Inkscape, and that's just how I do it. I'll tell you why I do that, even though you don't have to. I do that because then when the bitmap opens up in Inkscape, the canvas is sized to be exactly the size of the graphic, which makes exporting and doing all sorts of different things easier just because that canvas is already perfectly sized. If you wanted to go and start from Inkscape, go away. if you wanted to start from Inkscape and open it, you can do that, but, or actually you do import. But when you import it, it'll kind of just be floating out there. See, and it doesn't really affect the canvas of the document, so, but you can readjust the canvas to be the right size or whatever, but I don't know, I just like right-clicking and opening Inkscape, but, you know, your mileage may vary, do whatever is easiest for you. But anyway, once you have the graphic in Inkscape, woo, okay, we're ready to do our locats. So, normally the toolbar is easier to use because you can see the whole thing, but the resolution is very poor here. So you pick the text tool, and you basically just type on top of it. And you can see one thing is, I gave you that first tip, use the lock. I'm going to do that right now. I'll show you what happens if you don't use the lock. I'm going to scale my text, and it's going to be all weird and hard to read and stretched out. We don't like that. So hit Control-Z to undo. I'm going to hit the scale button, where it's going to keep it the right aspect ratio. Now when I scale it, it's nice, it's readable, no problem. I'm going to show you another trick here. What I mentioned before, Control and Shift are sort of magical. If I have this here and I decide, you know, I want this lolcat to be really loud. I want these letters to stretch all the way to the edge. It's kind of a pain to have to drag here and then drag here and then sort of fit it that way. So if you're here and you want to make it bigger, hold down Shift when you scale, and it scales out from the center rather than from the sides. So it's just one of those little convenience things. And, you know, as you use Inkscape more, you kind of start remembering those things, but just something, play around with Control and Shift, and you'll find these cool little things. So then, all right, this black text is not really doing it for me. It's not really jumping out. The text itself, it's not really bold. What I'm going to do first is I'm going to go to Text and Font, and I think I'm going to pick Deja Vu. By the way, most of the fonts, this is just like a little sidebar, most of the fonts on my machine are actually openly licensed fonts. There's a lot of awesome openly licensed fonts. Please look for them and use them. Okay, that's just my little service message there. I'll use Deja Vu because it's sort of a default font, and lolcat fonts aren't usually particularly sophisticated, and I don't think it's really a sophisticated font, so there you go. And now I have a nice bold font. I just used bold. You can also do Control-B, of course. That's another way. And then I'm going to pick a brighter color. Here I have this palette along the bottom, and it has a lot of colors. You can also pick out specific palettes. And some of these actually are palettes that I downloaded off of colorlovers.com. So those work with Inkscape. It's kind of nice. But I am going to go back to the default palette, if I can find it. Here we go, Inkscape default. And I'm going to pick like a nice bright yellow. So what you do to make something filled in with a color in Inkscape, the easiest way, just click it, and then click the color, and it'll fill in. Now, another example of how Control and Shift are magic, if you hold down Shift and click a color, that will change the outline, the stroke of the shape. Now, it's a little hard to see right now, but here now I'm zoomed in a bit more, and now you can see how it's changing. If you want to modify and if you want to make that stroke thicker or you want to manipulate different things about the stroke and the fill, you go to Object, Fill and Stroke. And these are way basic. If you've already played around with Inkscape, you probably already know these. But here I can make the stroke, I can make it 5 pixels, and now it's really thick, and then I can add it so it's rounded at the edges. You can see how it's changing as I do that.
That number in the toolbar. You see 5 there, down there?
Here, yep.
No. Down there in the bar, on the left. You see the number 5 there?
Where, here? Yeah. Oh, right here?
Click and scroll. Click and drag.
Oh, that is awesome. I didn't even know about that. That's an awesome trick. Thanks. I'll have to use that. Although it sucks, this laptop doesn't have a scroll wheel or even a scroll pad thing, so, but that's awesome. See, and you learn things like this at conferences like this, so it's great.
When you're giving tutorial.
Yeah. But, yeah, and now one thing that you might have noticed too as I've been working with this is I'm kind of zooming in and out a lot. You basically just hit the minus key or the plus key. You don't need Shift to do that. But see, then here's one of those instances. Oh no, where did my artwork go? I'm lost. Wow. I hit five. There it is. The other thing that five does actually is it zooms you in at 100%, I think, does it? No, it doesn't. It fits it so that the entire thing fits in the window. If you want to see what your artwork looks like, sort of at a 1-to-1 ratio, you can hit one, and that zooms it in 100%. You can also use this little bar in the lower right, but I don't usually bother with that. I like the keyboard instead. But that's how you do that. So here's your lolcat. You want to share it with the world. What I typically do is I just go to File, Export Bitmap. I'll do Page. So this dialog is a really confusing dialog in Inkscape. If you do Page, it's going to basically export everything that's in sort of this canvas area here, anything that's inside of it. But like if you do Selection, and say I have this here and it's not completely in the canvas, it's not going to export what's in the canvas, it's going to export the object that I have selected. And it doesn't just export the object that's selected, anything that's visible within the object that's selected. So you can see how this high eye is visible, that'll be in the export too. So this is like a lot of stuff you probably don't have to worry about too much. Just use the basic page export and you should be fine in most cases. So I'm going to do, and you hit export, there it is. And here's my lolcat ready to share with the world. All right, so what is the next project here? Okay, so now I'm gonna talk a little bit about the text tool and sort of how you can manipulate text, because the lolcat text is not particularly sophisticated. So here I'm kind of, our little storyline here is we're going to make a lolcat site just for lolcats that involve Tux the Penguin, because it might be kind of a cool site, maybe. So I have written out Tux's lolcats. I picked a nice openly licensed font here. The information about it's along the bottom. If you want to download it, you can right now. And I changed different line heights. So changing the line heights kind of can change the feel of a logo. When you make the line height a little bit less than 100, like here in the middle I have 70% line height, kind of crowds the logo in a little bit, but also makes it feel a little bit louder. And I kind of want that feel since this is a lolcat site and it's sort of a comedic, kind of funny site. So I'm going to go with that one, but these are the different variations you can do. You can also change up the letter spacing. So letter spacing is just basically the space between the letters. It's all it is. And I can show here the normal letter spacing, really tight letter spacing, where the letters are almost gasping for air, and then loose letter spacing where they're sort of just laid back, you know, hanging out there. And I like the tight letter spacing again because it's sort of a comedic effect. It almost looks like the letters themselves are sort of laughing and giggling. So I'm going to go with that one. And then you come up with the kerning. Kerning is the positioning of individual letters. So like you can see in the first example, I just moved the C so it was closer to the A. And it was just a little bit of movement. In Inkscape, you can actually hold down Alt and use the number pad, the arrows, and you can move and kern letters up and down, left and right, and you can also rotate them. So if you hold down Alt and you do the two square brackets, the left square bracket rotates it left, and the right square bracket rotates it right. And I forgot to mention, actually, to do letter spacing, you hold down Alt and you do less than, greater than. I think less than makes them tighter and greater than makes them looser. And the one thing that I hear about a lot about Inkscape from people who are used to other software is that you can't really control the letters. You can. All these features are not documented so well as the thing. They're not built into the UI. You just have to know the keyboard shortcuts to access them, but they are there and they're really convenient once you learn them, of course. You can also put text on a path. So here I took the Tux and I aligned it along an ellipse, and then I took lolcats and I also aligned it along an ellipse and I put them together. So this is sort of just a rundown of what I just showed you guys. You can change the line spacing, you can change the letter spacing, you can move individual letters and rotate them as much as you like, and you can also put text on any path. And when I say any path, I mean any path. Like, you could take a picture of, I don't know, a pony and put the text around the pony if you want. So we're going to try some of these techniques. Do I still got you guys? Still good? No eyes glazed? Okay, because I tend not to be the best speaker, so I just want to make sure that, you know, you guys are interested. Okay, so I'm going to take the text tool, and I'm going to type out. Does anybody have a logo they need designed? Because I can design it right here if you want.
IBM.
IBM? Oh, Paul Rand would not like that.
Universal subtitles.
Hmm?
Universal subtitles.
Is that a logo you actually want?
That's a logo I actually.
Okay. All right. Tell me a little bit about. Tell me a little bit about Universal Subtitles.
It's a project I've been working on. So I've been working on a lot of things we're working on too. It's a. It's going to be free software under the AGPL for placing subtitles on any video.
Okay. That sounds awesome. All right. All right. We'll do a basic. We'll start with a basic logo type, which is just a logo that consists of letters. And maybe if you can think, as I go through this exercise, if you can think of anybody actually, think of a logo mark that could go with that, then maybe we could design a little graphic to go with it too. Okay? And since it's an open source project, we'll pick an openly licensed font here. We've got a nice catalog here. Let's see. So what I do when I'm looking for, and I don't know how many of you guys might be designing logos, it seems like there's a lot of free software projects that need logos, so maybe you could help them out and try out this stuff after this little talk here. What I like to do is, first I type out sort of what the name of the project is, and then I'll open up the text tool here, it's under text, and font. And I'll hit a font name, and then I'll just hit the down key, and I'll go through and I'll kind of see, well, do I like how this looks? I don't know. If anybody sees one they like, just holler. I'm going through. La, la, la.
I like the first one you did, by the way.
The first one? Oh, the tux one? Or?
Well, you know, the very first one.
This one?
Yeah.
What do you think? Let's go through. Let's see if any others pop out. I like that one.
Yeah.
Because it's bold, you know, really easy to read. Some of these are not free fonts, and if they're not, I'll let you know.
Some other ones we were just tempted to find.
Which, what?
Yeah, maybe that.
Yeah.
This?
That, before, yeah.
That one?
Yeah.
Baymuck? Well, you know what, I'm going to pick something so we can move on, but if you guys want to change it up, you know how, right? So I'm going to pick, what am I going to pick?
That last one was kind of
accidental. Oh, I already moved.
Right before.
But by contradiction.
This?
Yeah.
This is the same one I used for the tux. We could use it if you want.
Yeah, it's too comic, I guess.
Okay. You want something kind of serious?
Yeah, a little bit serious.
How about Junction?
Yeah, sure.
Like Junction? All right, we'll go with Junction. Junction is a font that is Creative Commons Attribution License, I think. All right, so, you know, there's different things you can do when you're doing a font, or when you're doing a logo, you can think about, you can change up fonts, you can change up line width, you can change up if it's part is uppercase and part is lowercase. There's different things you can do. I'm just going to try this. And actually, if it's universal,
well, just put sub in lowercase and titles even in titles.
Okay. I don't know. See, this is a process that could take a long time. So I'm just going to go with something basic, and we'll see what comes out of it. So I have this. One thing you can do is I'm double-clicking this now, and I'll show you guys how to do the letter spacing. So I'm going to hold down Alt, and I'm hitting greater than. You see how that's opening up. So this is one thing you can do, sort of a common thing that people do in logos is you take sort of part of it and it's really big and then you take it smaller and you justify it basically, yeah. So you could do something like that. Let me see. You don't want anything goofy, but just so I can demonstrate it to you guys. If you hold down Alt and see how I selected, basically I took the text tool and I'm just kind of clicking and dragging to select letters. So like if I click and drag R, if I hold down Alt and then I start changing, I'm basically just hitting the arrow keys. So that R can move all around if you want. You can adjust it how you want. You can rotate it. Pretty cool. Now, one question people have asked me before is, okay, this is vector. So why don't I just make these letters paths and break them apart, and then I can just move them like they're shapes, right? So why do I need all this kerning and holding down Alt and doing all this crazy stuff? The reason that you don't want to do that is because now if I double-click this letter, I can't type over it anymore. It's been converted to a path. See? And this is what I was talking about with vectors earlier, is they're basically just these nodes here with the connectors between them. But once a letter has been converted to a path, you can't convert it back to a letter. So if you change your mind and you decide, well, we're not going to call it Universal Subtitles, we're going to call it Puppy Love or something, you can't change it because it's already baked into the path. So that's why these kerning tools are really useful, because you can actually go in and change the name of whatever.
Question?
Sure. What's up?
If you have some time, I'd like to show a little. I work in the development of Inkscape.
Oh, okay, sweet.
And I developed a feature to design fonts within Inkscape, which is really similar to that, those things that you're saying. So if you have 5 minutes for me later,
sure.
I can show it.
Sure, that'd be awesome. Okay.
Can you break the letters apart?
Maybe now is the right time.
What? Oh, well, let me get through what I got, and then we'll see where we're at. You want me to break the letters apart?
How did you break the letters apart?
Oh, so I could play with them like they were paths? Okay. This is something we'll go over a little bit later, but basically I took, and you can see where I did that. I do it without thinking. I hit this, and I hit Control D, and now I'm dragging it over here, and then I have it selected, and I go to Path, Object to Path. So now it's paths. Like, if I click the Node tool, you can see how these are paths. But when I click this, it's going to move as one unit, and that's because when you convert text to a path, it automatically groups it together. So if you want to ungroup it, you do Object Ungroup, and then you can take the individual letters and move them around. So that, and again, I've gotten into a situation where I've changed letters to paths, and I designed like this complex logo, and then somebody changed their mind and changed the name of the thing, and I had to go back and redo everything from scratch. So it's one of those things, you can do a lot more different things with letters that are paths, but it's sort of a trade-off whether or not, when you convert them over to paths, just save your work where it had the original letter forms, because if you ever need to change the name of the item again, it's convenient to just go back to the file and do that rather than have to create it from scratch. Okay, so that being said, we have a nice little, it's a very simple, very basic logo here, and let me see what, So I'm going to go a little bit more into the presentation and just sort of give you more basics, and we'll keep building on that logo. So these are some of the tools that you can use to create objects and shapes in Inkscape. The top two tools here are the selector and node edit. These are tools that you're going to be using constantly. The selector is how you select items on the canvas and move them around. You click and drag, you use it to select something, so then you can use a menu to change properties about it. So you're going to be using the selector all the time. There's also the node edit tool, and that's the tool that I just used to show you how the letters had been converted to paths. So see here, this is text. I hit it with the node tool. It doesn't show nodes because it's text. And say if I draw like a shape here, well, this is a case or object to path, and I click on it, then you can see the nodes. And the node tool will let you select those nodes and drag them around. So that is how you edit paths. Then we have all we also have the concept in Inkscape of objects. So objects are a little bit different than paths. Objects sort of have special properties about them, and I'll show you in maybe a couple slides how that works. But you have the rectangle tool, and that draws out a rectangle. One of the special properties of a rectangle is that you can round it. But once you convert it to a path, it's no longer considered a rectangle, and it's just considered flat nodes again, so you can't use that rounding tool. The same thing with the ellipse. With the ellipse, you just basically draw a circle. But there's special tools that you can, if you keep it as an ellipse object, like you can make it sort of like a Pac-Man kind of thing, or you can make it sort of a sliced circle. You can't do those things once you convert it to path. So you might be noticing a theme here. If you keep an object that you draw on canvas as the original type of object, you get more options that you can play with it. But if you convert it to a path, you kind of lose that extra ability. So that's one of those things. But you know, the pros and cons here of weighing it, once you get it to path, you have nodes. You can manipulate those nodes at a very fine level. While when you just use the tools that are specific to that type of object, you're kind of limited in what you can do. There's also the polygon tool. You can use the polygon tool to draw stars. You can use it to draw pentagons, things like that. And you know, that's another one of those tools that has a special bonus where you can just select, okay, I want 10 nodes, I want 20, or I want 10 points, I want 20 points. So you can have like a 20-point star and all these different things that you can control about it. There's a calligraphy tool, and basically the calligraphy tool is just you draw with it. Everything that you draw is actually an object. There's the text tool, which we kind of already went over in detail. And then I'm showing here too, which I already kind of showed you, is the that lock there. That's really important. And this area here, actually, whenever you have a tool selected, so you guys remember the tool options palette that I told you about in GIMP, right? Where, you know, you have the paint bucket selected, and then it shows you paint bucket specific options, so on and so forth. So in Inkscape, it's very similar. If I have the ellipse tool, it'll show me special ellipse options up in this toolbar area. Same thing with the star, all that kind of stuff. So these are sort of the basic shapes. If you just freshly install Inkscape, you don't muck with any of the preferences, these are the kinds of things you can expect when you use those tools I just kind of went over. But these are some things that you can do with those objects, if you keep them that type of object, using that special toolbar. So here I have sort of the example on the bottom of, this is the polygon toolbar. So when you start drawing polygons, this is how you can add more points to your star, or you can change it from being a star to sort of a closed shape like a pentagon. That's where you do it. And again, these are the pen tool is another tool where you can generate paths on your own. So now you're not starting from an object like a circle or a square or anything like that. You're drawing it by hand, and I'll show you how to do that. And this is sort of an example of the node edit toolbar. So just how the objects in Inkscape have specialized toolbars for each per object, when you're editing nodes, there's also special toolbars for doing that. When you're editing nodes in paths, there's different types of nodes. And I'm going through this in a whirlwind because we're going to review it once we're actually playing around in Inkscape, so don't worry. You have corner nodes, which is basically, it's just a very strong, sharp edge. You have smooth node, but smooth nodes, they can kind of be smooth in different ways. They don't have to be kind of perfectly an even arc. It can be a little lopsided, like in this example here. You have symmetrical nodes, where when you drag out those node handles, and you'll see them, they have blue lines there. When you drag out the node handles, the curve changes at even intervals, and they're locked together. And then you have auto nodes, and auto nodes, they're interesting. If you like draw out a sketch, and I'll show you guys, but if you draw out a sketch, and then it kind of looks a little awkward, like there's some points where it's just not quite smooth. If you turn some of those nodes on that point, on that side of the curve to auto nodes, it tries to kind of figure out the sweet spot where the curve looks really natural. So it's kind of one of those extra bonus features of Inkscape that's really nice. If you have a node and you'd like to convert it between these types, there's the node toolbar, and I've circled sort of on the bottom. That's where they are, and they basically look exactly what they are like. And just as sort of a little aside, I used Illustrator for many years before I picked up Inkscape, and this was the one thing about Illustrator that really killed me, because I don't know if it's like this anymore, but in Illustrator, you used to have to hold down like some, I think the Apple key on Apple or whatever, and then click, 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 click to switch modes of nodes, and there wasn't any explicit toolbar where you could click to convert between the different types. So Inkscape was really a breath of fresh air for me, because then I could see exactly what type of node it was and clearly move between them. So it's one of those things where I think Inkscape is actually a lot better than the proprietary alternatives. Okay, so this is sort of an example of the fake logo that I did, but you know, we're going to do the logo for the subtitle tool. Okay, so there's let's see, I'm trying to think of all those techniques. So we can do, did you have any ideas for sort of a logo mark?
It could be one line.
There were some ideas of doing like a speech bubble or speech bubble with lines in it or like something that expresses universal, like the globe, you make a big circle there, something like that.
Okay, or maybe a globe and a speech bubble.
Could be.
Let's try that. So, actually, I'm going to cover just one little section because it's going to help with the speech bubble. Let me see. So, there's also, once you convert something to a path, so I talked before about sort of the pros and cons. Once you convert something to a path, you can kind of modify the nodes and get this really fine-grained control, but you lose some of that, like, specialized object tools that you get if you keep it as an object. But once you have it as a path, there's different things that you can do with paths that are really kind of handy. this is one thing is you have these different functions. They're like path functions that I'm not exactly sure what Inkscape calls them. They don't actually call them anything. But here, like, I have two circles. And like here I show, okay, I unioned the circles together. So it basically takes the two circles, one on top of the other, and it makes them one shape. So then that, it's just one shape, it's not two circles anymore. There's also intersections, so if you take two circles and you hit intersection, it will delete any part of the circles that don't overlap, and then your shape turns into what the overlap was. There's also exclusion, which is basically exactly the opposite. Wherever those two shapes or paths intersect, it removes the intersection point. Then there's difference. So difference is where the path on the top kind of cuts the path on the bottom. It's almost like it's a stamp or some kind of cutting tool on top. And then division does the same thing, but it only does a line. Like, it only cuts. It doesn't actually remove anything. So hopefully that makes some sense. And you can see here I did sort of a shiny gloss effect with it. So I took I converted the text to paths. And then I took a rectangle, and I took a copy of the text, and then I put the rectangle on the top, and I did intersection. So then this little pink area here is sort of a separate shape right on top. Okay, the gray. Yes, you get the idea. So for the speech bubble, what I'm going to do is, first of all, you can see I'm going to fill it in white. Well, I'll fill it in gray so it kind of stands out against the white background. I don't know, I guess you can see that. And then I'm going to hold down shift, and I'm going to hit gray and give it sort of a gray outline, although that probably didn't change the color for you because you can't see red. And then what I'm going to do is I'll draw a triangle and make that sort of the point of the speech bubble. So how I'm going to draw the triangle is I'm going to take the pen tool, and here's how the pen tool works. So the simplest way to use the pen tool is you basically go click, 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 click. And as long as you start that square that opens up when you first start clicking, once you click that again, that closes the shape. So that's the easiest way, but you get a lot of sort of straight edge artwork that way. So one thing that you can do is you can kind of draw an approximate of what you want using these hard angles, and then you can hit the node tool. And you can see these are those things I went over before, how you can change the different types of nodes. So like if I want this to be sort of a smooth curve, I can hit this and make it a curve, and then I can start playing around with the curve. And actually, one example, any of you guys played Pac-Man back in the day? Yeah? So I can make like a little Pac-Man ghosty this way if I do da 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 da. And then I take the node tool here and I make it rounded. And you can see this is symmetrical, so you can see how when I'm dragging it, it goes symmetrically. Now, you can also see how I'm kind of wildly not very straight when I do this. If I hold down control, you see how it's snapping at different intervals? So if I want that curve to sort of be perfectly straight, I'll hold down control when I do it, and that ensures that I'm doing it in a straight manner. So anyway, that's another example of control and shift being magic. So that being said, I'm going to take the pen tool, and I'm going to use it to draw that little point of the speech bubble. So I'm going to do this. And then I'm going to take, because sort of that point usually curves a little bit when you have a speech bubble. So I'm going to click between these guys, and I'm going to make it, I'm going to use a different tool here, make selected segments curves. And I'm going to move these node handles and make that curvy. OK, that's great. So now, one problem that I'm faced with here now is that I have sort of the little entryway into my speech bubble, and I have the speech bubble, but they're not the same shape. What am I going to do, right? What you can do is sort of what that little point that I went over just before, where did it go? The path arithmetic kind of thing, where you're taking two paths and you're putting them together. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take that little entryway into the speech bubble, and I'm going to take the speech bubble, and I'm going to union them together so that they're one shape. So what you do here is I click the speech bubble, I hold down shift, and that will add things to my selection, and I'll select the little entryway into the speech bubble. Now, another way you can do this in Inkscape is if you have the selector tool selected, I'm going to click and drag, and you have like this lasso thing that sometimes gets wildly out of control. But anyway, you get this lasso thing, and you can select it, and that'll select anything within the lasso as well. So it's up to you which way you want to select stuff. Depending on your situation within Inkscape, different ways are more easy to do than others. So you can do shift, click, click, or you can lasso, whatever works. So now that I have the two selected, I go into path, and then I go into union. This is where all those things that I talked about are, those different functions that you can do on paths. So I'm going to pick union, and now you can see I have a speech bubble. So we want to do like a speech bubble with a globe in it. So we'll take the circle tool. Now this is another case of shift and control being kind of cool. Well, I'm kind of drawing a circle here, and it's sort of circular, but I can see how maybe I might make it a little too flat or a little off. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to hold down control when I draw the circle, and you can see how it's sort of snapping. So that makes sure that I'm doing sort of a perfect circle. So I'm going to take that, and I'm going to fill it in blue. That look blue? It sort of doesn't quite look like the same blue. But here you can see I'm centering the circle. Now earlier I showed you guys the trick where you hold down shift and when you scale, it scales from the center rather than the side. So I'm going to do that. And then I'm going to cheat again because I have my little guy here. And I'm going to use the calligraphy tool. So I'm viewing the different tools. I'll do green. And I'll just sort of scribble. And then I'm going to take these guys, and I'm holding down shift to select the multiple ones. And I'm picking, oh, for some reason they're not filling in. Well, that is weird. I'm not really sure why they're not filling in. That's a little strange. Oh, I know why, because they're calligraphy tool, right. Okay, so this is another thing. So with the calligraphy tool, when you draw with the calligraphy tool, you're actually not drawing a stroke, you're drawing a fill. So you see here, like I have this. Now, if I click on different colors, I can't actually fill it. It's only changing the color of the thing. And that's because if you use the node tool, you can see it's not actually a stroke, it's a shape. And I can drag these nodes in. And now you can kind of start seeing, oh, okay.
What have I done?
So see here, I'm picking, and that's the fill. Whoops. And if I hit a stroke on it, then the stroke is just going on the outside. I'm trying to pick a color that you guys can see with this projector. And then if I make this stroke a little bit thinner. There. Now you can see when I'm doing a stroke, it's not actually changing the color of the stroke, it's stroking the stroke itself, which is sort of strange. And that is because that is a path. There's a couple things you can do to get away from this. You can use the pencil tool instead of the calligraphy tool. So when you use the pencil tool, it actually is a stroke. So when you color it, it changes the color of the stroke itself. If you hit the color to fill it, it actually fills it. And you can see it's one layer. Or here you have two layers because the stroke itself is a path. The way that I prefer to do is I use the calligraphy tool, but then if I want to fill it in, I use the paint bucket. So that is what I'm going to do. Oh. So I'm going to give them green outline, and then I'm going to fill them in with a bit of a lighter green. And I zoomed in, too, because you might notice if you're zoomed out and you try to use the paint bucket, it doesn't capture as much. But if you zoom in, it gets more information. So then if you fill it in, then it fills in better for whatever reason. So there we go. So how are you feeling about the logo so far?
It's cool.
Okay.
maybe a little shadow for the, is there any way to make it a little bit like?
Blingy?
Hey, you actually do those in the real world.
Just like that. Oh almost. Approximation.
It's nice.
All right. So the next section of the presentation, and I think it's pretty much the last one before I go into the learn more, is about blinging stuff up. So we could try kind of blinging it up and see if you like it, and or we could throw it away, whatever. So the classic thing you do when you're blinging a logo is you do something like this, where you take a lighter color and you give it a very hard edge so it kind of looks like a gloss. And then you can kind of add a bit of a blur to it. You can add a drop shadow. You can kind of get a little ridiculous with it too. But I'll show you those kind of standard Web 2.0 bling techniques here. So first I'm going to do, because for blinging it's really easier to do it if, and all right, well, let me explain what I'm doing. So first what I'm going to do is I'm going to convert the text to paths. Because once I convert it to pass, then there's more bling possibilities. The problem is that if I goof, or if I had to change something, I've converted it to pass, so I can't correct the issue with the text. So the first thing that I do when I start blinging something is I actually select the whole thing, I hit Control D to make a copy of it, and I move that copy like off canvas, just so it's sort of a backup, just sort of so if I goof, I know I have, you know, a plan B. So then I'm going to select this, and I'm going to go Object Path, Object to Path. So now, it's a path. Okay. So then I'm going to take a rectangle, and I'm going to draw it on top, and I'm going to make the rectangle transparent. There's a tool here. In Fill and Stroke, you can change the opacity of something. So I'm going to make it sort of 50-50. I think you can see that. And now, where you can see that, where you can see where it intersects with the text, that's where the gloss is going to go. So I am going to make a copy of the text, and I'm going to move this on top. So now I have the rectangles on the top, the letters are on the bottom, and I'm going to do path intersection. And that did not work. Why didn't it work? All right. Here's another.
So we're doing a coffee break in a couple of minutes, and then after that we're going to come back and do so we're switching because there's another presentation at 3:30.
Okay.
So she's only told.
Okay. All right. Do we want to skip bling and then just go to questions, or?
How big is bling? Bling.
You like the bling? All right. All right. So what you just witnessed here is I tried to intersect these two paths and didn't work. So one thing that I don't always notice in Inkscape, but it's handy to have, although in this low res it's kind of hard to see, is if I try something and if it doesn't work, Inkscape actually tells you why. So I'm doing intersection, and now you can see along the bottom here. Oh, not there. Along the bottom here, one of the objects is not a path, cannot perform Boolean. So the issue here, and we're getting into the complexities of Inkscape now, is that these letters, while the individual letters are paths, they're grouped together. They're actually considered a group. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to ungroup them, object ungroup, and then I'm going to combine them so now they are a path. And you can see in the bottom now it says path. I'm going to move it back up. And I'm going to try again. Intersection. There we go.
Oh.
So now, and I don't know what color you guys are seeing, but you can see it's sort of a little lighter. So, and I could do the same thing to the subtitles, but you just saw it, so we don't have time. Whatever. So once you have this, you can sort of, you can select the glow part, and then you can add a blur to it. And that does interesting things. One trick I do sometimes, too, is I'll take the whole logo, I'll Control-D it, and then this arrow on the top, I'll drag it down to make it look like a reflection. And then I'll take the reflection, I'll do sort of maybe a 50% opacity, maybe even lower, add a bit of blur to it. So that's one thing you can do. It actually doesn't look as good with the blur. It looks a bit more like a reflection like that. Another thing you can do is you can take the logo, you can do Control-D, you can move it to the back. So in Inkscape you have the concept of objects can be arranged on top of each other and underneath each other and stuff. So I'm going to do lower to bottom, and then I'm going to add the blur. So the blur kind of pops out behind the logo. So that's sort of another way you can get a different look. I think that works in black and white. And you can do a glow on top as well. Much. But the blur tool in Inkscape is very sensitive, so like if you move by like 0.1, it will make a difference. If you start dragging out way too far, it will slow down your computer, so try not to do that. But you can see now that it almost looks like Chrome. You know, it's kind of a cool effect. So that's sort of how you do bling. It's basically you just duplicate, use those path functions to sort of cut out different parts of the path, use blur, go wild, see how it looks, see what you like. And there's also actually, if you're looking to do sort of the latest new bling thing, which, you know, I'm not always up on my bling, this might be dated at this point, but if you, you know, just search around for different tutorials, a lot of the tutorials that people do for Photoshop and Illustrator actually apply quite well to Inkscape and GIMP, so give them a shot. If you ever have trouble translating them, just ask. My contact information is in these slides, actually, on the front page, and I'm going to be posting them to the website, so feel free if you want to ask for advice on it. You know, I can help you kind of translate between the two. And actually, that's kind of a good segue to the next section, how to learn more. So these are just some resources. These will be posted to the wiki on the Libre Planet page. And these are just some resources you can learn more about using these programs. Recently, I taught a class of middle schoolers how to use Inkscape, and they had, they're basically producing designs for rock bands and then having rock band t-shirts printed out at the end. And we covered a lot of these basics really in depth. I put like the material from four or five different classes into this Inkscape section here, so it went really fast. If you want to follow at a more measured pace and have some exercises to follow and things like that, check out that website because it has all that stuff. There's Floss Manuals. Floss Manuals is a great resource if you want to learn more about how Inkscape or GIMP or even programs like Blender and OpenOffice work. It's sort of a great place to have a definitive source. Screencasters.heathenx.org is a great site. He has video tutorials on using Inkscape. He tends to focus on the latest new trendy blingy things, so if you want to learn them, that's a good site to follow. Meet the GIMP is another video tutorial site, and it's pretty active site. He's actively posting new videos, so it's one of those ones that's good to follow too. Gimpology is one of those sites that they kind of aggregate tutorials from different sites onto one blog, so it's good to find all the GIMP tutorials that are out there in one place. And then there's also the Inkscape tutorials blog. It's the same deal. They kind of pick out good Inkscape tutorials from around the web and aggregate them in one place. So, any questions? We have like 2 minutes, I guess. Sure. Well, Firefox isn't exactly working, so
no,
we can try.
It's Big Hat. Hat.
Oh. Yeah, this isn't working very well. The awesome bar is not actually that awesome. Okay. How's that spelled?
J-U-C-A. Oh, okay.
Sure, I
do. Just to explain you, Inkscape is based on web standard. So W3C defined the standard for doing vector graphics for the web. So just like you can manipulate HTML with JavaScript, you can do some vector graphics. All this stuff she was doing. When you save a drawing in Inkscape, it is saving an XML file.
Oh.
All the drawings you do in Inkscape are saved as an XML file, and this XML file follows a standard defined by W3C. So you can manipulate it using JavaScript. You can do all the cool stuff that you can do on the web. That's one key point of Inkscape. One key target of the project is supporting this web standard for vector graphics. Good news, not for us, free software developers and users, but for the whole internet, the good news is that Microsoft is going to support SVG in their next browser version. This means that SVG will not be any more neglected, and I hope it will be treated more seriously, even by Mozilla that supports it, but it's not a top priority. But now that, Microsoft will do it, they probably will do it more seriously also. Inkscape does not support the whole set of features of SCG yet, but one of the things that I would tell you that at the time she was doing fonts.
No, what was that URL again?
Big Hat.
Okay.
I have to close and open it?
I think I have it on my USB card.
As soon as you open the browser, it should work.
This is a USB card.
I'm sorry, I have no idea how to use it. Let me just do it.
Just a pen drive.
Yeah.
The awesome bar is really not
awesome.
Yeah, go to
awesome. Code there.
Okay.
Code. SVG probably. Down there, down. SVG and minigame. Minigame SVG. Down there. Minigame.svg. Yeah. This was drawn in Inkscape, and then there is JavaScript code to manipulate the drawing and with interaction with the keyboard and so on, with a game rule. You can play it. By clicking on the drawing and also by using the keyboard.
I said the resolution is so poor.
Just
awesome.
A tiny game, but it's all designed in Inkscape and programmed in Gedit.
can we really go play?
Yeah, she's playing. So that's the kind of technology that we are trying to support. That's what we want in the place of Flash. We don't want Flash anymore.
Can we see the source of this?
Yes, sure.
Okay, give us the URL.
Well, the source will be a bit complicated because it's just XML.
This is what it looks like.
Automatically by Inkscape. But you can open the SVG file in Inkscape and draw something there, and it will appear in the game.
I want the Inkscape source.
SVG is Inkscape source.
Yeah.
So you can open any SVG in it.
This is the file format saved by Inkscape.
So here I saved it. I saved it to my desktop, so I'm going to do open with Inkscape.
Then you can draw a star and open again on the browser so that you can see it.
I need a video of how you made the game in Inkscape.
Okay. No, to make that, you just draw anything in Inkscape. Then you select a certain element. So, hide this layer with the... select the instructions and
I can load the game in Inkscape.
Yeah. No.
And take it apart.
Yeah, but it will not run.
It won't run the same way.
No.
There's
so
no
what
information lost.
So delete.
Well, oh, just delete it. Okay.
Yeah, delete. Just so. Yeah. You see the tiny butterflies?
Yeah.
Select one of these.
So
butterflies.
You wrote a JavaScript program here.
Yeah. You see, she selected the butterfly. Right click, object properties. You see that it has an ID, MSN 2C. 2 is second row, line C. This is just the name I chose.
Second layer?
No, line and column.
These are arbitrary.
Yeah, so I chose this ID arbitrarily. But then on the JavaScript, I do just like in HTML, you do a document.getElementById and you get an ID.
You can get that butterfly.
You can do that. You do svgdocument.getElementById, msn2c, you will get a reference to an instance of that path. So you can set CSS styles, you can manipulate the document object model of the SVG on browser in runtime. Using JavaScript. That's why we animate and change colors and blink stuff and interact with the keyboard. Just like you do with HTML and JavaScript, you can do with SVG and JavaScript. because it's a web standard. It's designed to work seamlessly. Yeah.
That's it.
And the rules of the game are you have to hit the Microsoft butterflies to increase the GNU Linux market share.
So I need the JavaScript for
it. Yeah, JavaScript. Can you show the minigame.js?
Sure.
This is the game source in JavaScript.
Oh, so I got everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you can see this is where, like, MSN2C.
Yeah,
this is
yeah,
where it's referencing
right
that butterfly.
Thanks. That's it.
So.
And regarding fonts, there is one specific part of the SVG standard that allows one to draw arbitrary shapes and drawings and select that and say, this is what I want to be the glyph for a certain character. And then you can design a font using Inkscape. So I want the A glyph to be this drawing, the B glyph to be this, the C glyph to be this one. And then you can type text, and it uses your tiny portions of drawing as a font. And you can save it as an SVG, load it into another software called FontForge, which is what people usually use to make fonts, and generate other font formats, such as TrueType and OpenFont. And so Inkscape can be used to design fonts also. It's in text, SVG font editor.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but it's kind of buggy now, because we were a lot concerned about implementing the standard, so it's not very usable yet.
Okay.
Steph?
Oh, no, it's good, thank you. What's up?
Yeah, I just want to thank you for the explanation of GIMP and Inkscape. That it's, I've not been afraid to read the manual or build it from source, but this has been very helpful.
Awesome. Thank you.
The lock is open here, is that correct?
Oh, that's fine. Thank you. If you have any questions, this is going to be, oh, what?
Earlier when you were drawing shapes with the pen or the pass tool, you kept drawing closed shapes. I'm wondering if it's possible to get an open shape.
Draw an open shape. Well, so how you get an open shape is you can just do the, let's see. So like you draw a circle, right? If you want, oh, so you can click this when you draw a circle. See how it's sort of sliced? And then there's this toolbar up here. You can make it sort of, is that what you mean by open shape?
No, you were showing one tool where you draw your own paths and you have to finish it by closing, clicking on where you started.
When you draw a triangle.
Oh, right. Yeah, the pen tool. Oh, yeah, you can absolutely draw an open shape. What you do there is to stop, because the thing is, if you keep clicking, the line is going to keep following you and it won't go away. Double click.
Okay.
And there you go. Then it's a shape. So, okay, cool. So if you guys have any questions or anything, this presentation is going to be on the wiki. My contact information is going to be on there. You know, so cool. Go use GIMP and Inkscape and create openly licensed works. All right? Cool.